Thanks for downloading from WRTI. This is Jim Cotter. For more information on this and all the other programming you hear on the station, go to our website, wrti.org. While you're there, you might consider becoming a member, renewing your membership, or making an additional gift. This podcast and all of the programming you hear on WRTI is made possible by our listener members. Why not become one now? Thanks, and enjoy the show. Hello, on this week's program, David Patrick Stearns reports from the Philadelphia Orchestra's tour of Europe. We speak with Nick Stuccio, producing director of the Philadelphia Live Arts Festival and Philly Fringe. And Eric Brannan takes us to a new site-specific production by the Philadelphia dance company Movement Brigade. Constance is performed on and explores the history of the Schuylkill River. That's all ahead this morning on Creatively Speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Nobody can accuse the Philadelphia Orchestra of staying in an ivory tower during its current European festivals tour of Switzerland, Germany, Britain, Ireland, and France. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns is touring with the orchestra and begins this report in Dublin at that great tourist attraction, the Guinness Storehouse, home of the iconic beer. On Monday, at the top floor Gravity Bar, visitors enjoyed a panoramic view of Dublin and sipped pints of a rather different kind of music, a string quartet drawn from the Philadelphia Orchestra playing Schubert's Death and the Maiden.
Here we are at the top of the Guinness Brewery overlooking all of Dublin. To the left is Trinity College, founded in 1529 by Queen Elizabeth I. And to the right is St. Patrick's Cathedral, which was built on the site where it is believed that St. Patrick, yes, the St. Patrick, performed his first baptism.
But they were fantastic. Please give them another big round of applause. And if anybody wants to hear them tonight, remember, they're in the National Concert Hall. A fantastic place to hear an orchestra like that. Absolutely. The best of luck to you. Okay, thank you, everybody.
How, you might wonder, did these musicians end up here? This unorthodox Philadelphia Orchestra manifestation was instigated by none other than concertmaster David Kim.
I was just signing up for tickets for a tour of the brewery, and then I was looking around the website and they said perform at the brewery, and then they even have a little YouTube clip of some high school band or something, and I said, hey, we're the Philadelphia Orchestra, we'd like to try, and they said, we'd be delighted to have you come and play.
The circumstances weren't all that unusual for the young cellist Yumi Kendall.
Well, in a way, it actually makes us focus more in a different way. We're sort of in this nucleus of concentration on our quote-unquote stage. So for me, it actually makes me focus in more. It does make us play louder, sort of like a wedding gig back when we were in college when people aren't really quiet and focused.
And at the Guinness plant, bar manager Teresa Toot has seen just about everything.
We had, last year we had a quartet from some part, wait, let's see, were they Swedish they were from? Some part of Sweden, yeah. Did you like the bar here? Lovely, isn't it? Yeah, you need a pint now. Get ready for tonight.
How could it not go well? And just to prove that they were really there, some of the musicians hit the gift shop on the way out, where there were Guinness golf balls, Guinness soccer balls. It's interesting to note that the Guinness t-shirts here in the Guinness gift shop are wider at the bottom than they are at the top, obviously tailored for those who drink a lot of Guinness. Other orchestra members had more earnest missions in their spare time. Through a series of connections, cellist Udi Bar-David brought his Intercultural Journeys group, heard here with clarinetist Ricardo Morales and percussionist Don Liuzzi, to the small oval-shaped St. Andrew's and St. George Church in Edinburgh. The Church of Scotland's Interfaith Relations Division assembled a program that had religious leaders of all persuasions discussing compassion, integrity, and other virtues with cross-cultural music selections from the Philadelphians. But the tour isn't all tributes, hearts, and flowers. Though concert programs are typically rehearsed before anyone gets onto the airplane, the Edinburgh Festival specifically requested something with a Nightingale theme, prompting chief conductor Charles Dutoit to program Stravinsky's Song of the Nightingale, and a tough piece like that had to be vigorously whipped into shape while on the road. But what Dutoit particularly relished was a set of new bells donated by orchestra board member Frank Slattery for the final movement of the Berlioz Symphonie Fantastique. Previously, the orchestra had what's called bell plates, square metal plates that make bell sounds. They date back to the Leopold Stokowski era. Dutoit wanted something more precise, and he wanted it bad. Therefore, two bells were cast in the Netherlands and used in the orchestra's Lucerne date for the first time, though not before Dutoit rehearsed them in his typically meticulous fashion.
Sorry, 1 second, wait.
Backstage Lucerne, principal percussionist Chris DeVinny talked about the difference in the new bells.
Well, first of all, there's a greater sustain, ring time, but more importantly probably, these are more focused of a pitch. The bell plates have a wider overtone spread, and so these are more like real church bells. The other bell plates are similar sounding, but very menacing sounding, and that's what we've always used in the past.
Are something that the orchestra members don't want to think too much about amid the current Chapter 11 bankruptcy proceedings that have given the tour a dark undercurrent. Orchestra President Alison Vogelmore isn't here mainly because she has more pressing matters at home. What the players most dread is the forthcoming contract negotiations and what they'll be like under these financially distressed circumstances. Concertmaster David Kim.
There's also perhaps a little bit of sadness because we wish we were just on this tour making music and not having to worry about all the pension and all that stuff. I mean, the stuff that we, many of us, are learning for the first time, you know, and it's, we're musicians, but unfortunately we're getting a real quick education and all this other kind of business stuff.
In any case, this anxiety isn't getting in the way of some great playing, which would solve everything if applause could pay the bills. Yet, applause is a starting point, and a big one. The audience at the Guinness Brewery, for example, didn't know what it was getting, and certainly wasn't expecting anything like a string quartet from Philadelphia. But even under those circumstances, listeners seem to have heard and felt all of the right things. And isn't that the point?
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. The Philadelphia Orchestra's 2011 tour of Europe continues with performances in Dresden, Frankfurt, Berlin, Cologne, and at the Proms at London's Royal Albert Hall. It ends in Paris on Friday.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
So our next item this morning takes us out of the studio and to the former high-pressure fire services building at Race Street and Columbus Boulevard in Philadelphia. And beside me is a man who's going to explain why we're here. Nick Stuccio, co-founder and director of the Philadelphia Live Arts and Fringe Festivals.
Well, this is the site of our new home. We've been searching for the ideal festival center for quite some time, and we love this building. It's kind of perfect in many respects. We needed a building, a place that we could have year in, year out to conduct our festival business in, and that's all the box office sales we have every year, a social hot spot that we use every year. Every year up until hopefully next year, we find a location, we spend a lot of time, energy, money on rehabilitating it to sort of what we need to have for our festival center point. And it costs us a lot of energy. And so if we have a building, a site that is ours, that we own, we control year in, year out, we no longer have to reinvent the wheel every year. So we're very excited. And this building is perfect for many reasons. One, it's in Old City, which is a great, great dense neighborhood of culture. Two, it's right across the street from New Ray Street Pier, which is a beautiful new park in Philadelphia, fantastic park. It's an acre right out over the water. And three, this building, it's adjacent to Old Ray Street, which is going to be stricken, partially stricken, and given to us with building. And so we'll have this immense outdoor plaza as a great component to a great art center. We also love the building itself. It is historic. It is a perfect rectangle. That's 10,000 square feet of clear space inside. The building height is 30 feet tall. So the theater that we're planning for the inside at 30 feet of height will make a beautiful theatrical lighting and give lots of possibilities for artists. So we love that aspect of it. And since it's just this wide open rectangle, we can do anything we want with the interior. The exterior is also fantastic. It's historic, and there's 14 openings in the building, and we plan on restoring all of them over time and the money that we can raise, so that will be a limiting factor. There's four doors to the building. Some of them are 25 feet tall. Once they're restored and we put glazing back in them, the views from the interior space, and we plan to have a great restaurant and bar in this building. The views through those windows and openings are going to be fantastic. The Ben Franklin Bridge is 120 feet away from the front door. The views of the river and the pier and the boats going by are going to be spectacular.
The Fringe and the Live Arts Festival are famous for conducting performances in exotic and sometimes obscure locations. Did that feed into you finding this building? Because this is a building that I'm sure we've all driven by 1,000 times and never seen.
That's right. We do put works on in unusual, empty, found spaces. Audiences love to have that adventure of leaving the theater and being in great different kinds of
a hotel pool thing. Or a hole in the ground in Fairmount Park, and
exactly.
The list goes on.
And artists are very inspired by that, very inspired by their surroundings. So part of my job and our job here is to be aware of those potential spaces out there for artists to use. And, of course, we had known about this building.
Well, how? When did you find out about this building?
Well, we were in Old City for 10 years, 11 years. And I lived right down the street for many years, so I always knew about it. And from the exterior, you don't understand. It's hard to understand the volume of space on the interior of this building because it's kind of set into the ground a bit. The grade is steep on one edge of the building. And so when I did look at this building...
But the floor is perfectly flat.
Floor is perfectly flat, absolutely, on the inside. And a big end of the building is kind of buried in the ground. But once inside, you could see the great volume of space. And also, I thought there are some massive, amazing pumps in this building. It's tremendous, which we have to cut out and sell for salvage. But I assumed that it was filled with so much stuff that was rooted into the earth that there were pipes that we would never be able to get rid of until, again, being in here. And have some engineers in here.
And when did you come in here? When did you first walk in here? And what was that wow moment? Because you just opened these enormous 25-foot high doors to let me in, and I walked in, and I'm guessing that I had the same reaction that most people have, which is wow.
We've been looking at this for almost a year. And when I was with a couple of board members. We walked in here, and we all went, this is it. This is the building we want. And that's right, the aha moment of seeing the interior, the beautiful clear space, and knowing the location was really great.
And it's in pretty good condition.
The building's in excellent condition. The roof is brand new. The four walls are perfect shape. It's a very solidly built building, and the city has kept it up beautifully.
Let's talk about how the acquisition of this building changes the makeup of your organization. You go from being a festival organizer to being a year-round presenter. Mm-hmm. Does that change the culture? Does that change the mindset of your organization?
Yeah, it does. I mean, on this issue of being a building owner, we feel like we've gained a lot of experience over the years. The building we're in right now is a big building, about the same size in terms of the square footage, and we manage it ourselves entirely now. So we've gotten a lot of experience the last 2 years in terms of facility operations. On the issue of the year-roundness, in addition to running a festival, yeah, that's going to change the culture, and we're doing a lot of good thinking, of good planning. I mean, we've been well into a year of regular strategy sessions about what the culture here will be like once we're in year-round mode. And we need to grow. We're going to need to grow to some degree to have both a great world-class festival like we have now and to add a year-round programming. And we can scale up into that. We can slowly build up that year-round programming as we build out the infrastructure to support it. I mean, we're going to need more marketing support. We have just the marketing team, for instance, that we need now to operate a world-class arts festival once a year. So we're going to need more folks to do that year-round. We're going to need more fundraising capacity. We're going to need more production staff and so on. And we're analyzing all of that. We're costing all that out. We're trying to understand what the cost implications are. Our board is very involved in that discussion. We have a great consultant, Nancy Bird, who's helping us analyze all this very, very cold and in a cold and calculated way to say, this organization, this is the impact of this facility and this year-round programming. We have a lot of, I think, smart thinking that have gone into it. I mean, we intend on, we'll have more earned revenue through ticket sales.
Can it be a profit maker?
No, I'm sorry. I have to laugh at that, Jim.
Well, you're going to have a restaurant. You're going to have a bar on a waterfront.
Yeah,
I mean, that's a pretty healthy commercial proposition.
Well, but you know enough that the restaurant and bar industry, very few of them actually make money. And almost all of them go out of business at some point, right? I mean, our hope is that we can float. If there's any positive flow in terms of that operation, that would be fantastic.
But are you going to run it yourself? Or are you going to call Stephen Starr and say, I've got a piece of property here you might be interested in?
We're talking to some folks. In fact, Stephen Starr is on our board. And Audrey Teichman, who owns 20 Manning Grill, and Audrey Claire, they've been a great source of help in thinking through all this. Fergus Carey, who's a great old friend of ours, he's been very helpful to think through how we're going to do this. We don't know yet whether we're going to do it ourselves or hire a third party. We're not sure about that yet. And there's also the potential of facility rental. This is going to be a beautiful building in a great location. And, I mean, we all are we're sober about the fact that this restaurant business is never going to be probably a great source of revenue for us. But the facility rental business might be. And that's something that we're thinking, given the conditions here, might be a source of revenue.
Well, let me ask you a final question tangential to that. Do you already have in your mind a programming philosophy for this place? Does it have to reflect what happens in the Fringe, / Live Arts? And secondly, if you're getting into facilities rentals, can that be weddings, or does it have to be something that's going to reflect on what you do as part of your programming philosophy?
Well, on the program philosophy, we have one mission, and that's about the contemporary arts and the experimentation and boundary-breaking artists that we love. That's not going to change during the festival or year-round, and we'll present that kind of work here. What this does give us the opportunity in a year-round way is a couple of things. One, where there's a great show that people love, like, let's say, one of Brian Sanders' show or Pig Iron's show, Yuba City, of a few years ago, which we ran during the festival, got great attention, it was a great show, but once the festival ended, it ended. We can bring a show like that back, or we can let that show run longer beyond the festival and really play out the audience potential for that. So that's kind of work we're going to do. We'll do a variety of local and hopefully some more national, international work. And now having a year-round program, that does open up many more possibilities for adding a run of great work that's happening in New York, for instance, here in Philadelphia. We have currently a 16-day window. And if work is on tour during that time, we can bring it in. But that rarely, if ever, happens. Many companies don't tour in September, many international companies. But now, if a really fantastic company is coming to New York or Washington, we can add a run-on in Philadelphia. It's a much greater economy of scale, and that'll open up a world of possibilities. Some of the companies that we love to bring, and we should see here in Philadelphia, might take us years, literally, to have them
get on their calendar.
Yeah, to get on their calendar. In fact, C.D. Larbi-Cherkawy is an artist I met 16 years ago in Edinburgh. And over the years, I've tried to see about his work, but, he's not been available. But It's taken 16 years. He's finally performing here in a great work called Play. He's amazing, one of the best, world's best dancers. 16 years because I have a 16-day window. It finally fit in 2011. So we'll be able to do that. We can take advantage of an 8-month season. So that is going to be great. And in terms of what we'll do here in terms of facility rental, we're still working that out. But hey, man, we got to pay the bills. And if there's a lovely wedding that wants to happen in here,
it'll have to be an existential wedding.
Exactly. But yeah, I whatever it takes to raise the money to do our work, and if it's going to mean some rentals that are sort of outside of the mission in here to help pay the bills to keep the great work happening and thriving here, then I think we're prepared to do that.
Nick Stuccio, producing director of the Philadelphia Live Arts and Fringe Festival, which runs through September 17th. And while the Fringe promises a slew of convention-breaking performances in venues around the city, a production that's arguably even more adventurous began last week on the banks of the Schuylkill River in Fairmount Park. Now WRTI's Eric Brannan takes us to Constance, a performance odyssey designed to illuminate some of the lesser-known history of what was once known as the Hidden River.
There's no exact address listed for the location of Constance, the latest offering from Philadelphia dance company Movement Brigade. A visit to the production's website yields only directions to a green boathouse, located a quarter mile south of the intersection of Black Road and West River Drive. When you arrive, you're met by a stagehand with some important production materials.
Here's a life jacket for you. Let me know if you need a bigger size.
Life jackets? For a dance theater piece? Well, that's where the canoes come in, but we'll get to that later. Audience members are also outfitted with dark ponchos, which in the darkness of an 8:30 p.m. performance resemble cloaks or robes more than modern rain gear. John Howell from South Philadelphia wasn't sure what to expect.
At this point, I've got no idea. I'm surprised to be given a life preserver and a poncho. I'm all about it. I'm just surprised. You know, I never turned down a boat ride.
Despite the early mystery surrounding what Constance actually is, its creator, Movement Brigade director Ali Vidic, says the piece has a simple purpose.
It's a project that is really about histories of the Schuylkill, particularly Philadelphia history, that aren't usually discussed as frequently. And then the other end of it is that it's really trying to be interactive for the audience so that they not only hear history, but also experience the river.
After being outfitted for the performance, audience members are led into the darkness towards the riverbank, where a strange song emanates from the trees. The song is sung by the unofficial guide for the evening, a woman dressed as a crow, meant to embody a local Native American myth.
Long ago, it was said that a fox would be let out into the world. It was also said that four crows would come.
The legend details four periods in Lenape history, from before European colonization to the Lenape's subsequent persecution at the hands of the colonists between 1600 and 1800, to the 200-year period in which the Lenape kept their identities a secret. It concludes in contemporary times, as many Lenape are now publicly celebrating their heritage. The myth is used to loosely connect the various bits of history referenced in Constance, like Philadelphia's 19th century typhoid outbreak, the river's connection to the Underground Railroad, and the rise and fall of the waterway's shadfish population. Ali Vidic says they're all united by one thing.
I was looking at all these different histories, and I was like, well, the only thing that connects them is the river. And the river is the only constant, and that's not going to change. People will leave, and people will come, and cultures will no longer exist. Even the river can be changed, but it's the only thing that has stayed a constant throughout all these other histories.
Come with me, follow me, fly with me.
After a short trek down a dark wooded path, you're brought to a small inlet, then helped into one of three canoes and rowed out onto the Schuylkill by an oarsman dressed as a deer, a bear, or a beaver. These animals were chosen because they all at one time populated the area. In addition to their responsibilities as navigators, the animal guides are also performers, setting an eerie mood by reciting dialogue and singing as they row the audience to yet another unknown location.
Feel a gentle, warm breeze, and nothing else.
The canoes stop at a small clearing on the otherwise densely wooded western bank of the Schuylkill. There, two ghostly figures are featured in an unrestrained dramatic dance, sometimes falling to the dirt of the shore.
We really are using the beach almost like a stage. So the audience is like, their seats are in the river. Looking at it, like, I like to see that that backdrop is kind of involved and that people don't look artificial.
Through a blend of dance and theater, these performers are portraying sufferers of Philadelphia's 19th century typhoid epidemic. Ali Vidic says that Constance needed to be multidisciplinary to achieve its goals.
For this piece, I don't know how it could just be a dance piece, because it would be impossible for us to be dancing on the canoes. And then I find so much of a wall sometimes when I'm trying to really share a story, and it just be through movement only.
Throughout the rest of the performance, the audience moves from beach to beach, watching vignettes informed by different periods in history. One location is the densely forested Peter's Island in the middle of the river. Vidic says that while working in rugged locations like this can be liberating, it also has some drawbacks.
Things that you don't think about when you're in the theater and you're like, this is the dressing room. We're like more putting things in the back of a car. There's not many tools to use. You know, you're doing a natural show. We don't have any power in our show. Everything is battery-powered or solar-powered. We have some solar-powered lamps.
Elise Moreau, who wrote the show's original music and plays the crow who greeted us earlier on, says that the logistics of theater weren't the only difficulties in making Constance. She recalls a time in dress rehearsals when she took a seat on a log while waiting for the canoes to arrive.
Worst idea ever. I had so many bug bites all over me. And these were not mosquito bites. This was like bird mites. And we have various stories about different bugs and plants that have attacked us. Christina, who plays the deer, she stepped on a wasp nest.
Last weekend's hurricane and subsequent rise in water level has also made things trickier than expected, says Moreau.
The water level is totally different right now than it was when we first started. So the piece, when I go out onto, you know, Third Crow, I used to be able to just like walk on over to that log and it was fine. And after the rain, we were like, I think I need a boat to get there. Like, how do we figure that out?
Despite the difficulties of staging a show like Constance, Ali Vidic says it can offer audiences perspectives that a stage show never could.
I want people to be like, I live in a beautiful place and I didn't even know it because I haven't even been on the river. And I want them to just see it in a new way and realize that it's something that we can't take for granted. And it's not just like a geographic point. It's actually a part of our culture.
Seeing the splendor of Philadelphia's modern skyline at night from a vantage point rarely accessed by city dwellers, while at the same time considering the people, wildlife, and landscape that predated it, makes for a powerful contrast. And despite the consistent clamor of traffic from the expressway that permeates a performance of Constance, its contemplative text and dramatic setting makes it easy to let yourself go and live some of the history hidden in the Schuylkill River.
WRTI's Eric Brannan. The final performances of Constance are tonight and tomorrow evening on and around the Schuylkill River in Fairmount Park, starting near the intersection of West River Drive and Black Road. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under music director Rossin Milanoff. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.